So let's begin, if we shall, in John chapter 9. Excuse me, John chapter 5. John chapter 5. Actually, yes, John chapter 5 and verse 19. We read, "Therefore Jesus answered and was saying to them, Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself, unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself is doing. And the Father will show him greater works than these, so that you will marvel. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son also gives life to whom he wishes. For not even the Father judges anyone, but he who has given all judgment to the Son, so that all will honor the Son even as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come into judgment, but has passed out of death into life." As we observe these spring feasts, as has already been mentioned, we observe God's wonderful plan of salvation. We celebrate his love and his grace. And as we read, it is the Father's plan. We could actually turn to many different scriptures where Jesus Christ emphasized that it was not his will, it was the Father, his Father. He was there to do his work and to help implement his plan. It is God the Father's plan. It does not, in essence, originate from Christ. So one thing is interesting about the term of Christians and following Christ. Maybe it could be potentially a misapplication in that we focus on following the Father, just as Christ followed the Father. But that being said, what is the balance? Because once upon a time, we may have focused so much on the Father, as we should, that we did not focus on Christ as we should. Because as we read, God the Father has delegated his plan, has communicated his plan to his Son, and has asked his Son to take up that mantle and all that pertains to, of teaching, of healing, of bringing the great plan of salvation. So we should have that balance, the balance of the Father, and it's the Father's will, and it's the Father's plan. But as we have discussed already this morning, the sacrifice of Christ and the resurrection. What does it mean for us? Today I would like to cover the miracles of Jesus Christ recorded in John. Because in those miracles, I believe that Jesus, our elder brother, did convey thought process. He did convey meaning. He did convey instruction. And indeed, if we are to internalize Jesus Christ, if we are to take his example, if we are to take that bread and ingest that bread and put it into us, it's helpful to understand that thought process. It's helpful to understand those examples. So let's look at these miracles that we recorded in John and review these lessons in context of the days of unleavened bread. Let's start off in John chapter 2. The first recorded miracle by Jesus Christ in any of the Gospels. And this is the infamous turning water into wine. And we read in John chapter 2 and verse 1, "On the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding." So it doesn't say who. We have to potentially assume that it was a very good friend, potentially a relative of Jesus' mother, and that by extension, Jesus Christ and his disciples were also invited to the wedding. In verse 3, when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now, this, you may think, in our day and age, no biggie, let's just switch to beer, or we'll drink water, or we'll still have fun. But in that day and age, due to the traditions, if you ran out of food or drink, especially wine, at a wedding ceremony, it was a bad thing. It was a major social faux pas. You were even to the point of being potentially ostracized because of your lack of attention to tradition. So potentially running out of wine or food at a wedding ceremony was a big deal. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." Now, woman in our day and age maybe isn't the most respectful. "Hey, woman." Kind of reminds me of when a minister and his wife were watching our kids when we were away for a weekend, and my youngest, who was like 5 or 6 at the time, walks into the kitchen and says, "What's for dinner, woman?" He didn't hear that from me, I'm telling you. But so in today's day and age, not so. But in that, it was actually a term of respect, a term of affection. So it says, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has yet not come." And the reason why Jesus Christ said that, "My hour has not yet come," what does this have to do with us? My hypothesis is that he was already establishing or looking at a potential conflict with the Pharisees in tradition. As I mentioned before, it was a tradition of the community. I should have done the research. I'm not sure if it came from the Talmud or if it's just tradition or social tradition, but to exert so much on what went around the wedding. And I believe that Jesus Christ was already starting to potentially show his confrontation to that type of approach. The wedding ceremony is something that was ordained by God. The focus is on that relationship between the two and Jesus Christ. It's not a focus on wine and food. This is also kind of comparable to a few years back. I had visited on business India and was able to attend an actual wedding ceremony, an Indian wedding ceremony in Pune. And hearing the stories, it is a week-long extravaganza, but so much money is spent on the wedding. We think we spend a lot of money here. So much money and so much tradition and so much specifics and particulars are spent on the wedding, to the point that family members will sell property that they've had in their family for generations. They will sell jewelry. Because to not put on an extravagant affair would be considered an offense in the Indian culture. And it reminds me a lot. And I believe here in Jesus Christ is once again starting potentially to confront that. It's not his time. But in verse 5, his mothers, yes, can be persistent. I'm sure was asking Jesus Christ. And so his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to do, to you, do it." Now, there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. So, part of this whole question of tradition, there was a purification ceremony, and so Jesus Christ used the same vehicle. It said, "Fill them up." And verse 7, fill the water pots with water. So they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. When the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, he did not know where it came from. But the servants who had drawn the water knew. The head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, the person responsible for the wine and food, and said, "Every man serves the good wine first. When the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you have not kept, but you have kept the good wine until now." So as you can imagine, once again, going to this issue of the tradition and to the issue of the tradition of man, people knew what to do. Serve the good stuff first, and when people can't tell the difference anymore. Then you bring out the watered down stuff. You bring out the stuff from the year that maybe wasn't so good. But we see, though, when Jesus turned water to wine, it wasn't the bad stuff. Everything that Jesus Christ does and God the Father does is with quality. So he shortcutted the fermentation process time, and it was the best quality wine that we read. In verse 11, this beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So in this miracle, we see a few things. We see Jesus Christ focus on quality. We can say that Christ has power over quality. What he does is quality. Our calling out, our conversion, is a miracle. It is through the grace of God he provides us to open our eyes, to understand his way. It is a miracle. And through this process, God only wants the best. He wants the quality for you and for me. So Jesus Christ has power over quality. The second miracle, let's go to chapter 4. John 4. This is the healing of the nobleman's son. Chapter 4, in verse 46. Therefore he came again to Cana, the same place he was before, with the water to the wine, Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine, and there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. Now it's a royal official. It's not clear whether this was an Israelite or a Gentile. My personal belief is that he was a Gentile. But he was facing a trial, and it was a trial that drove the nobleman to seek intervention. Just as we face trials and we get to the point where we say, I need help. And this is where this nobleman was. Verse 47, when he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and was imploring him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Now, imploring, the word there is the imperfect tense of begged. It was a repeated persistence. It wasn't simple a question or can you please, but it was imploring. He could have been on his knees asking, his hands raised, but he was imploring. But even in that, the nobleman's faith was maybe just a little bit imperfect, because he said, can you come down? Can you come to Capernaum and heal my son? You have to be there physically. You have to be there in presence, for he is at the point of death. Verse 48, so Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. This statement could be taken a few ways. Some may say it is a correction or unless you see miracles, you're not going to do anything. But there's also a different way to read it and to view it. And that is Jesus Christ just making the statement. Where they were in their faith and their beliefs, they had to see miracles. And that's what he was there to do. The royal official said to him, verse 49, come, sir, come down before my child dies. Once again, thinking he had to be there in person. In verse 50, Jesus said to him, go, your son lives. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and started off. Now, it was potentially a day's journey back to Capernaum. And so as he was now going down, his slaves met him and saying that his son was living. So he inquired of them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. So the father knew that it was at that hour in which Jesus said to him, your son lives. And he himself believed and his whole household. We see here that Jesus Christ had power over distance. He didn't need to be there in person. He had power over distance and space. It was the faith of that nobleman. It's one kind of interesting aspect having to, the privilege, I guess, for the lack of a better term, the privilege of being able to be an assist to God's children, that when they need help and they ask for an anointed cloth or they ask for prayer and we can't get there right away, but we put an anointed cloth in the mail. And it's humbling to see the amount of people that respond and said, as soon as I asked, my son started feeling better, his feeling broke, or my migraine started getting better. It's not just the physical. We go through certain acts to demonstrate our faith and our commitment, but we know that it is the combination of our faith in Jesus Christ, our faith in the Father, but his ability to have power over distance. And we kind of contrast this with the Pharisaical approach to control. If you can imagine the priests and the Pharisees, they would have had a big event. They would have had lots of pizzazz. They would have made sure that everyone knew that it was they and their hands laying on. Plenty of glitz. In this case, Christ focused on the healing and the glorification of his Father and his works. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 35. Keep your finger in John, obviously, as we'll be coming back. Isaiah chapter 35. Isaiah chapter 35 and verse 3. Encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. Say to those with an anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will shout for joy. For waters will break forth in the wilderness and streams in the Araba. It's God's promise and commitment that he will heal. He has power. Wherever we are, whatever we're doing, whatever help we need, he has that power to reach out and to help. Power over distance. The third miracle. Let's look at chapter 5. Continuing on. Chapter 5 and verse 1. The healing at the pool of Bethesda. This is really kind of an interesting story. After these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, as having five porticos. As an aside, in looking at some of the archaeology, it was actually a twin pools. But these pools, we read in verse 3, and these lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered. And for some of your translations, beginning now with the next word, it would be in brackets. And the belief is that this next statement was added later in a later manuscript to help explain what was going on at the pool of Bethesda. And Bethesda, by the way, meaning house of mercy. Verse 3, and these lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first after the stirring up of the water, stepped in and was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. Once again, this being added later to the manuscript, it might be a question of maybe the waters themselves had healing properties to them, and those who were initially there when the springs came in, as opposed to the community water that came in, had certain medicinal effects. It doesn't matter for what the story is, because as we go on to read, in the example that Jesus Christ was giving, a man was there who had been ill for 38 years, or another way, he was in his sickness or affirmed, 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time in that condition, he said to them, "Do you wish to get well?" Thank you. Speaking of healing waters. Do you wish to get well? Now, interesting, a couple things. The man did not ask Jesus to heal him. He didn't say, "I know you're the Son of God. Please reach out, touch me, heal me, lay hands on me." He didn't. He didn't even know who Jesus Christ was. If we continued reading, if we had time, we'd continue reading in chapter 5, and we see the story about actually the man did not know it was Jesus Christ until he went to the temple later, saw him, and Jesus told him. And then the man actually reported it to the Pharisees. So he didn't know who he was. In verse 6. Once again, when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time and said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the water when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." It was interesting. He didn't even answer the question. You know, Jesus said, "Do you want to get well?" And he responded with, I'm saying, excuse. The poor guy was hurting. Many of us have struggled where we can't use an arm or a leg, or through our infirmity or getting old, we start losing muscle mass. Well, not having moved for 36 years, you can imagine this poor man was in pretty bad shape and not able to move. He needed someone to pick him up. So he didn't even say yes, he wanted to be healed. But then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your pallet, and walk," or pick up your bedding and walk. Immediately the man became well and picked up his pallet and began to walk. His healing was immediate, and it was not over the pool waters. Another example of a certain tradition, or even once again, if there were certain healing properties. Jesus Christ did not need the pool of Bethesda. He didn't need for this man to be first into the pool. Jesus Christ had a power over ritual. He has a power over tradition. Continuing on in the next miracle, John chapter 6. I remember growing up in Bible stories. This is one of the first Bible stories I remember from the New Testament. It's a great story. The feeding of the multitude. So after these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. A large crowd followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Then Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near. Therefore Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing what a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?" Notice Jesus Christ's concern, his care for those who were wanting to understand more, who were following him. Now, as an aside, once again, holding your place in John, let's look back to Mark chapter 6. This is a parallel recording by Mark, and it adds a little bit more that adds another layer of texture and understanding. So Mark chapter 6 and verse 35. When it was already quite late, his disciples came to him and said, "This place is desolate, and it is already quite late." Now this is his disciples saying this. The next statement, "Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." So obviously notice the contrast. Jesus was saying, what can we do to take care of these people? The disciples are saying, go away. Go find whatever you need. Go into the countryside. Go into the towns. I don't care what you have to pay. Just go take care of yourself. In verse 37 of Mark 6, "But he answered them, 'You give them something to eat.' And they said to him, 'Shall we go and spend 200 denarii on bread and give them something to eat?'" Now, a denarii at the time, supposedly, according to all the smart economists, was about 17 cents. Which you may think is not a lot, but actually that was a day's wages. So Jesus Christ was saying, go get them something to eat. And the disciples were saying, this is 200 days or 8 months worth of wages. You could feel their pocketbook starting to ache. Their IRA starting to sneeze. And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go look." And when they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Let's go back to John now. So first we see the response from Philip was quite concerning, because it did not reflect a heart of service, first of all. It did not reflect a heart of care that Jesus Christ was showing to make sure these people were fed, because they had not, our assumption or reading between the lines, they hadn't eaten. They were following him. They weren't stopping. They were following him. So they were in a spot now that they could eat. They were probably pretty hungry. So the first thing was a lack of reflect. The second thing then that was concerning from Philip was that it reflected a binary thinking of process. In other words, on and off, hot and cold. It was very logical. Okay, well, if you want us to get them something to eat, then we're going to have to go spend our own money. And it showed a lack of faith. And is that us sometimes, where we're facing a trial, we're facing a need, we need help, and often we can put that trial in context of our own thinking, our own logic, where Jesus Christ has something completely different in mind. And that is the case here in John chapter 6. And so in verse 8, one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are these for so many people?" So at least Andrew was a bit more optimistic. He was saying, what do we have? Here's what we have, but how far will it go? Because 5 barley loaves are actually not loaves of bread as we're thinking of them, but barley cakes. And so they're barley cakes and 2 fish, and they're small fish. So in other words, this was the boys' lunch. So we got 5,000 people to feed, and we have a boy's lunch. Verse 9, "There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people?" In verse 10, Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men, and other, it's men, women, and children for other parallel versions, sat down, and they numbered about 5,000. Then Jesus took the loaves, and having given thanks, it's only 5 loaves, 2 fish, but Jesus Christ gave thanks for that boy's lunch. We can never overestimate the power of God's gifts and what we need to be thankful for. And he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. A few things as well. So, with the going out and buying 200 denarii worth of food, it would have been barely enough to satisfy. And one of the disciples said, it's not sufficient for them. It's going to be very little. But here, there's a couple things to note. First of all, just like the wine, I'm sure it was very good quality of fish and very good quality of bread, because once again, our father and our brother does nothing less than shoot for good quality. And the second thing was that not only enough to satisfy, but it was enough that they were filled. They were able to consume as much as they wanted and as much as they needed. In verse 12, when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Now gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost." So that nothing will be lost. So they gathered them up, filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. A couple of things to note on this. First of all, you know, starting with 5 loaves and 2 fish, feed, but now you have so much left over. But Jesus Christ said, "I don't want it to go to waste," in that he doesn't want anything lost. His desire and his Father's desire is to save everyone. I believe it's a symbol that he does not want to lose. And he says other parts of the scripture, he does not want to lose anyone. But secondly, he does not want blessings to go to waste. This was a miracle. This was a blessing. This is something God had provided. But it shouldn't go to waste. Which I think then is a question that we need to ask ourselves. What do we do with our leftover blessings from God? As God gives to us, and he gives to us in different ways. He gives to us financially. He gives to us a blessing of talent. He gives to us a blessing of good-naturedness. He gives a blessing of fill in the blank. But also, he blesses us with miracles when we're in need and God gives. The question is what do we do with the leftovers? Do we let them go to waste? Or do we collect them up and say, "I want to put this to use. I want to pass on my blessings to others." I believe that the lesson that Jesus Christ was giving, in addition to another miracle to the masses so that they knew and understood that he was the Son of God, he was giving the lesson to his disciples about what type of heart they wanted. You know, Philip, you have so much lack of faith, you don't understand what we can do. You're thinking in binary terms. I will show you what I can do, but then I want to show you the love that you need to have in your heart. We see here in this miracle that Jesus Christ had power over quantity. His blessings, we can shake it, we can shake and add more to the sack, because how much God blesses us is never ending if we keep our faith. So let's move on then in chapter, continuing on in chapter 6. We see the next miracle is kind of tied to this feeding of the thousands. And afterwards, Jesus said as many times, and his disciples had to try to leave town because those wonderful folks, I say that, I guess, sarcastically, who wanted to have that control, who wanted to control God, then were out to bring harm to this guy that was showing the mercy and the power of God, and not through them. So they had to often flee, and this was the case as well, that they then had to escape across the river. In verse 16, "Now when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, and after coming into a boat, they started to cross the sea to Capernaum. had already become dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea began to be stirred up because a strong wind was blowing. Then they, when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the boat. And, as you can imagine, they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid," or "stop being afraid." Let's also, once again, from a companion standpoint, let's look at Matthew chapter 14. Because in this case, Matthew, once again, adds a little bit more than John to the story. John chapter 14, verse 23, or verse 22. "Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. After he had sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray, and when it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already a long distance from the land, battered by the waves, for the wind was contrary." And the Sea of Galilee there is actually sunken. So when it cools and you have the cool winds actually coming down the mountain into the lake, it causes the water to churn. And you can get pretty nervous. As a matter of fact, Mr. Knack and I can think back to the times that we're on Lake Namekin up in Canada, SEP, doing canoe trips, and you wouldn't think a lake could provide much danger, but trust me, being in a small boat on a choppy lake makes you a fervent prayer. It gets you scared. And so, verse 25, "And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, 'It is a ghost.' And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid.'" Now, a few things here. First of all, it's a lesson for us as a reminder that these disciples had already seen so many miracles. When there was a need, Jesus Christ said, "I will fix that need." And so once again, there was a need. And the disciples, knowing that they had the Son of God with them, started being afraid. You know, why didn't they call out? Why didn't they say, "Help me"? It's not recorded if they did or not. But all we know is that they were afraid. And it's the same for us. We've been sitting here many years. In some cases, we're new into the faith. But either way, even seeing all the miracles recorded and seeing the miracles in our life, in our lives, in the faith in Jesus Christ, we at times can face our turbulent waters and become quite afraid. We face the same challenges. But Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I, do not be afraid." They first thought it was some type of vision or a ghost and some type of manifestation, a demon, who knows. But then they heard his voice. "It is I." The disciples were able to recognize his voice. We need to be careful that we can always recognize and hear his voice. It's easy for us to allow things to drown out his voice. It's easy for us to allow the cares of the world. It's easy for us to allow our own desires. It's easy for us to allow personalities and administration in ministry. It's easy for us to allow the personalities of the people we're sitting next to. I'm not talking spouses, by the way. Just kidding. So we can allow different things, if we're not careful, to to drown us out, to lose that voice. And we need to be careful that we do not lose the ability to hear and recognize that voice. Just as they. In verse 29, and he said, come. And Peter got out of the boat. Verse 28. Peter said to him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And he said, come. And Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came towards Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became frightened. So even for Peter, this is double. He was already afraid. He recognized it was Jesus, said, I want to walk to you. He was able to. But then he saw the wind, saw the waves, thought, what in the world am I doing? And he began to sink, and he cried out, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and took him hold of him and said to him, you of little faith, why do you doubt? When they got into the boat, the wind stopped. And those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, you are certainly God's son. I believe that this miracle was obviously for the disciples. It wasn't for the multitude. It wasn't for the crowd. It was for the disciples. And it was a miracle that demonstrated Jesus Christ's power over fear. His power over fear. We all fear at different times. But just like Peter sinking, we say, Lord, help me. Jesus Christ reaches out his hands and says, I have you. I have you. This is not a difficult walk. This is not an easy walk that we're on. It's not easy at times to demonstrate your faith in a way, especially in this day and age where you express any type of position on what you believe Jesus Christ teaches in right and wrong, and you're immediately branded a bigot and a hater. You potentially can land yourself in hot water trying to explain yourself for making a simple statement of God's way. We can easily be taken over by fear. But Jesus Christ has that power over fear. If we listen to his voice, if we reach out our hands, his hand is there to pull us into the boat. The sixth miracle is healing of the blind man in John chapter 9. John chapter 9 and verse 1. John chapter 9 and verse 1. And as he passed by, he saw a blind man from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he may be born blind? Now, this is in reference to Exodus 34, verse 7. For your notes, we won't turn there for the sake of time, where it was explained about the sins are passed down from generation to generation. So his disciples, believing that, okay, this man is sick, it had to then be something because of what he did or his parents did. Binary thinking. But instead, Jesus answered him in verse 3, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God may be displayed in him. It was misfortune. It wasn't due to sin, but it was a misfortune that this man's sight was gone since birth. Verse 4. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. In this miracle, Jesus Christ is focusing on his and our purpose. Notice in verse 4, he starts off by saying, we must work the works of him. We must work. It wasn't him saying, I must do this, but he's clearly saying, we. We are all responsible for working the work that God the Father gave Jesus Christ. If we pick up that mantle and we say we follow Jesus Christ, we're committed. It is not because we want to be saved. It's not because we want to escape the tribulation, but we are here to work the works. What Jesus Christ was doing through his miracles and showing that he was the light of the world. Are we working the works? Continuing on, in verse 6, when he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing again. Now it's interesting, why clay and why walk? Before he just said, "You're healed. Take up your bedclothes. Start walking." But in this case, he applied the clay to his eyes and made him walk. I believe this symbolized the spiritual blindness. I believe that Jesus Christ was showing that just like the scales on the eyes, there are those who are spiritually blinded since birth. They have not heard the name of Jesus Christ. And he said in two ways. One, that people have been spiritually blinded. And the second, it's a walk. We've already talked about the walk and Christian walk. So in this case, he's given an example, a specific example to this person and those around him about the clay and the walk. And in verse 8, therefore the neighbors who and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, "Is not this the one who used to sit and beg?" And others were saying, "No, it can't be. Yeah, it's him. And he said, "I am the one." So they were saying to him then, "How were your eyes opened?" How is any of our eyes opened? And he said, "The man who was called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went away and washed and I received sight." And they said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, I don't know. And then, once again, for the sake of time, we won't cover it, but if you continue to read in verse or in chapter 9, we see then the man talking to the Pharisees. And we see the Pharisees' response, once again, that of control. First of all, wait a second. You did something that was against our traditions of the Sabbath. And what we say you can and cannot do on the Sabbath. We know that Jesus said that the Sabbath is made for man and not man for the Sabbath. To do good on the Sabbath, he was doing good. But the Pharisees wanted to control and control who had access to their God and the God of Moses. We see here in this miracle that Jesus Christ had power over misfortune. There are those who are spiritually blinded, who do not know. And what is our response to those folks who are spiritually blinded? Is it a one of scoffing? Is it a one of avoiding because they're bringing it upon themselves because of their choices, because they don't believe God? It's because of their sins that why should we even bother? However, Jesus Christ has power over misfortune. And he, in his miracle, was showing that his miracles extend to all. He was there to open people's minds. That is the heart that we should have and the love and the care that we should have over the misfortunate. The next miracle, chapter 11. It's the raising of Lazarus. If we review the story in chapter 11, now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary, and his sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So as you can imagine, for whatever reason, the physical family of Jesus Christ is very close to these sisters and their brother. They must have spent a lot of time together and very close. And so the sisters sent word to him saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." But when Jesus heard this, the sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so when he heard that he was sick, he didn't stay 2 days longer in a place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. Are you going to go there again?" And Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the light, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." This he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep." The disciples then said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus then said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead." It's an interesting perspective, because we know that Jesus Christ has power over distance. He could have easily said, "Through your faith, Martha, Lazarus is healed." But that didn't happen. Lazarus died. And if you can imagine the pain that Martha and Mary were going through, and even Jesus Christ, because it says later he wept. But they were going through this pain. In our trials, and in what God is working through us, there are times as well that we go through pain. Having just recently lost a father, sorry, I'm going to get through this. Sorry, Mom. There is pain. And it's interesting, because having gone through this the last few weeks, you think you're by yourself. You think there's no pain that can top this, and no one is going through. And then you start talking to people. "Yes, I lost my father, and I lost my mother, and I lost a family member." And you realize that, no, you're just now one of the club. But there's pain. There's hurt. And we go through trials where we ask for God's intervention. We ask for God's help. But we still endure hardship. We endure pain. We endure those trials. Dropping down to verse 21. Now talking with Martha, he said, Jesus, verse 21. Excuse me, verse 21. Martha then said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." It's a beautiful response, knowing, understanding God's plan of salvation. But Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And if everyone who lives and believes in me will never die, do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." When she had said this, she went away and called Mary, his sister, saying secretly, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she got quickly up and was coming to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. And then the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, when they saw that Mary got up quickly and went out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, "Same thing. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled, and said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come see." Jesus wept. So the Jews were saying, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind have kept this man also from dying?" So Jesus again, were deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and the stone was lying against it. And Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Mary, Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for even he had been dead for 4 days." And Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they removed the stone, and Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it so that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And the man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with the cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." And I, as an aside, I take on these wonderings that Mr. Dowd talks about. I wonder what in the world Lazarus is thinking. What? Why is this stuff on me? Why are you people staring at me? What's going on? Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. We see here with this miracle that Jesus Christ has power over death. Mary and Martha understood, because they said they understood God's plan of salvation. They knew and understood that they would see him again. But Jesus Christ had to go that extra step to say, "No, I have power over death." We started off this reading in John 5 where the power was given from God the Father to Jesus Christ. That he has that power. He has that power over death. Let's look quickly at the eighth miracle, the last one. So many people think about Jesus Christ's ministry and say there are seven miracles. Actually, I believe that Jesus Christ's ministry extends beyond when he died. So we'll look at the eighth one, John chapter 21. So actually, after Jesus Christ's death and resurrection, we see here that the disciples were together. In verse 3, Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." And I'm not quite sure if he just needed to get away, or if he needed food, doesn't really matter. But they said, "We will also come with you." And they went away and got into the boat. That night they caught nothing. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to him, "Children, you do not have any fish, do you?" And they answered him, "No." So I'm sure he was masking his voice. And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find a catch." So they cast, and they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So it was just, if you imagine the passion and the excitement. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and the fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said, "Bring some of the fish which you have now caught." And Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although they were so many, the net was not torn. I think this is a beautiful wrap up, reflecting back to that lesson, that powerful lesson that Jesus Christ gave in feeding the multitude. And yet another way of Jesus Christ saying, "I will take care of you. I will provide." God's plan of salvation is a manifestation. It's a continuation of miracles. God's plan of salvation, when you think about those miracles, it's a miracle of our conversion. It's a miracle of God removing those scales so that we can see, and then removing that spiritual blindness to his way and the way that brings happiness. We see that miracle of Christ's sacrifice, and now that the bread of life living in us. These miracles are always in accordance with God's plan and God the Father's plan. Jesus Christ intervenes in a way that is fitting for us in his purpose. When we think about this miracle, we think about our dedication to God's plan of salvation. We think about these holy days, and now what does this mean for me? What does it mean, Christ living in me? What does it mean for me? What purpose? Christ, just in these same miracles, he intervenes in our lives. And we see these miracles manifest in different ways. We see these miracles come to people who it happens after pleading. God, please. We see these miracles come after a demonstration of perseverance. The infirm man who for so many years was by that pool. It was his perseverance that led him to that point where Jesus Christ was there and intervened on his life. Sometimes Christ intervenes after a simple request. And we see in those miracles, we see a variety. Sometimes we see a variety of timing where Jesus Christ responds immediately and says, here you go. Here's your help. Other times, it's after a demonstration of our faith that we're willing to put clay on our eyes and we're willing to walk before we see that miracle. Other times, the timing is after we think that we need the help, where we go through pain and suffering and we say, I can't take anymore. We then see God reaching out and saying, I will take care of you. God's miracles don't always come in our plan, in our time frame, and as we would like, as much as we would like to do that. But just like the Pharisees, we don't control God. God has his plans. He has his lessons that he wants to give us. But we can never, ever lose sight of the fact that how God gives that lesson and allows us to go through that lesson, that he has power. And his power is victory. Victory for us in pursuing his ways. And what are we supposed to do then? As Jesus often said, especially towards the end of the miracles, then through those miracles in us, that we are to be a light. We are to be a message. We are to carry on the works of our great Father.